So I thought I'd just ask you, well, when you hear this idea, when you hear the word spiritual death, and that this is the year of spiritual death, and this is a seminar on spiritual death, what's your response to that? When I ask for your response, I'm kind of meaning maybe if you give me just single words or one or two words, like what do you think when I say the word spiritual death? Does that sound like something attractive or not attractive?
Intimidating,
okay. Thank you, Mike.
It feels like release and relief.
Uh-huh, okay. Interesting contrast. Yeah.
Why does it have to take so long?
Why does it have to take so long? Okay, Thomas.
So do you mean what's being delivered at the centre or what?
No, the dying part. Yeah.
I was thinking ambitious. Getting it done in a year seems ambitious.
Okay, yeah, okay. Your dive address?
Nothingness.
Nothingness, okay. And does that feel like a, when you say nothingness, has that got a positive or negative association?
Positive,
okay. Yes?
Opportunity for change.
Opportunity for change, thank you. Yeah?
This is a rookie point of view. What do you mean?
What do you mean? Okay, brilliant, okay. Yes?
Grateful that the subject
is addressed. Okay, so grateful that the subject, okay. Yeah, Dai Badra?
Scary.
Okay. Yes?
Timing, why now?
Okay, yeah. Good. Yes?
Transformation,
okay.
How far
does it go? Okay. How you get on scribing?
I think I missed one only. No, maybe not.
Okay.
How far?
Okay. Any others? Yes?
Not ready.
Not ready, okay. Yes?
How many times?
What's that, Sylvia?
How many times?
How many times, okay. Thank you, Sylvia.
We haven't got more space here.
Hmm?
We haven't got more space here.
Okay, we run out of space. If we could maybe squeeze one last one down here. Has anybody got a last one?
Growth. Yes.
Growth, yeah, and then someday I'll allow to...
Letting go.
Growth, letting go, okay. So, let's have a look. So, what strikes me, and I'm sure it struck you, just listening to this, it seems to fall into sort of three groups. There's questions, like how far does it go, why does it take so long? We could add to that, like, does it take very long? Why now? What do you mean? So we've got some questions, which I hope might be addressed this evening. And then we've got, you know, this interesting contrast, haven't we, of words, some words like intimidating and scary and not ready, sort of contrasted with words like
transformation,
opportunity, growth. See, that's quite interesting, isn't it? If somebody came in and they didn't know what I'd asked them about, they'd probably be quite intrigued with the variety of responses that some of them seem almost opposite to each other. Yeah, so that's an interesting start. That's very good to get your responses to begin with. And I hope that what we're going to cover this evening will kind of sort of make sense of some of these responses, make sense of why there would be such kind of almost opposite responses. So let's see what happens. So I want to kind of, in a way, leave that just for a moment and ask you another question. And this, I'm going to go back to the life of the Buddha. And I'm going to ask you, I know some of you know quite a bit about Buddhism and some of you are new to Buddhism, newer. So those of you that know a bit about the life story of the Buddha know that he was brought up in a palace. Actually, maybe we could have another bit of paper and I'll tell you, don't start writing yet, let's see when. Know that the Buddha was brought up in a palace. And at some point in his kind of late 20s, he left the palace. Yeah? He left the palace. So what my question to you is, what was it that propelled the Buddha to be? He wasn't the Buddha yet. To leave that palace life. He was living in a palace, a life of luxury, but in another way quite imprisoning. So what propelled the Buddha to leave the palace? It's not a trick question. Yeah.
Dissatisfaction.
Dissatisfaction, yeah.
Sight of a dead body.
Okay, where is that? I heard a voice. Sight of the sight of a dead body. Yeah, they're both not incorrect, yeah.
Curiosity.
Okay. Actually, maybe could you write down those things, actually? Dissatisfaction, sight of a dead body, curiosity.
Thirst for knowledge,
yeah. So that's also not incorrect. So, Nico?
The desire to end suffering.
The desire to end suffering, yeah. That's right. What did he see as well as the dead body?
The four sights,
yeah. So if you look at the four sights. And what were those four sights?
An old man.
Uh-huh.
A sick person. Uh-huh. A dead body. Uh-huh. And a wandering holy man.
Okay, so that's the four sights. So I think most of you might be familiar with those four sights. Apparently, actually, if you were being strictly speaking correct, the Buddha, it wasn't actually the Buddha that we think of as the Buddha who saw those four sights. It was a previous Buddha. But let's not get too technical. In a way, we can see it as a sort of, just an allegorical sort of even archetypal tale. So let's take it that the Buddha saw those four sights. And we've, in a way, my second question has already been answered by some of the things that people said. So we've got the old man. Okay, so could you write up?
Yeah.
Thank you. Could you write the old man, the sick man, the dead person, and the wandering mendicant? So, if you were to put these, he saw them, the story goes, doesn't it, that he saw them one at a time, that he wasn't really supposed to go out of the palace, but he did go out of the palace. And each time, successively, he saw one of these sights. I'm assuming people are, on the whole, familiar with this, but are people familiar with this story, on the whole? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so, if you were to take... I might stand up, it might be a bit easier. So if you were to take... I'm going to group these four sides into two. So I'm going to put the first three into one group and then the last one into another group. So if you were, what might you collectively call these three sides? We've got some answer from above. So what might you collectively call them?
Impermanence,
yeah.
Mortality,
yeah.
Suffering,
yeah. Yeah. So he saw impermanence, mortality, and the experience of that was suffering. It was a real shake-up for the Buddha when he saw that it was like it propelled an existential crisis. He thought, well, what He was young, he was handsome, he had everything he wanted, but he at that point said, well, what's the use of all this if, you know, everybody gets old, sick and dies, you know. In seeing those sights, he realised his own mortality, his own impermanence. Yeah. And if you were, what did this, seeing this wandering mendicant represent?
Possibility,
yeah. I don't know who said that, but very good. Yeah, Sam, thank you. So I saw that possibility. Possibility of what?
Escape from suffering.
Okay, yeah, okay. So a sort of sense of possibility of escape from suffering. So maybe even the word possibility itself is quite key. So what do you think would have happened? So it's interesting the Buddha saw all these four, isn't it, I think. So what might have happened if the Buddha never saw that wandering mendicant? If he only saw that old man, that sick man and dead man, and on seeing him realised his own mortality? He wouldn't have known about
hope.
So he wouldn't have known about hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wouldn't have known about hope. Yeah. That's a very good way of putting it. Yeah. And what might have happened then if he didn't know about hope?
He might have stayed in the palace and just enjoyed all of his wealth.
Yeah. Do you think so?
There's no point.
Yeah, that's true. So he might have stayed in the palace and enjoyed all as well.
Well,
you might have got depressed. I have a tend to go more with the depressed, but actually, I see what Sarah means. Yeah. Yeah, probably we could divide the room, couldn't we? Probably he'd have done one or the other, wouldn't he? Yeah, he'd have either stayed on the pass and thought, well, I might as well just, you know, enjoy the dancing girls while I can as well. He might have got depressed, yeah.
Cynical and nihilistic.
He might well was. Yeah. I think there's a good chance actually, because remember he didn't just see them; it hit him like these sights. You know, he really realised this is going to happen to me. You know, this is going to happen to me. So what if he never seen these people? I remember Clyde actually asking this question when he just was out for a walk one day and he saw that wandering mendicant. What do you think might have happened?
I think he would have questioned why.
Yeah.
Why are they doing it?
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense, right. Okay. Yeah, wouldn't have made... That's quite interesting, isn't it? To wonder, well, why does somebody, you know... from his point of view, of all these riches and everything, why was somebody wandering around in rags? Yeah, Thomas?
He may have dismissed it.
Yeah. I think there's a good chance he might have, you know, because presumably other people were seeing that wandering mendicant, if you take the story on that level, you know, and yeah. So I think he would have wondered why, and that could have led to him dismissing it. Does that seem kind of credible to people, that may have happened? So that's quite interesting, isn't it? That you kind of need both. You need this experience of suffering combined with the experience of some sort of possibility and some sort of hope. The one without the other. Well, in a way, just the suffering without the possibility is a bit either depressing or will just lead to sort of thoughtless kind of hedonism. And actually, without the suffering, interestingly enough, I've just realised in this talking to you, you don't actually experience the hope. You just experience, oh, what's this guy doing wandering around dressed in rags, for heaven's sake, you know. Why, you know, you just dismiss it. So you don't get to experience the sense of a way out of suffering if you aren't in touch with this mortality in the first place. Does that kind of ring, you know, do feel free to disagree with me if you like.
I think he was really very aware of what's going on anyway. So, I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I'm saying he was at a different level already when he was in his palace, the way he was looking at the world. I don't believe the story that he was totally unaware of what was happening outside the palace. He was just waiting for more insight, I guess. And when he saw the mendicant, and then when things clicked.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, again, an experience we can be aware of ourselves. I mean, probably all of us. It's not that any of us have literally never seen anybody sick or anybody known. Probably all of us have known somebody who's died, even a close person who's died. But sometimes we see that more deeply, don't we? Or sometimes we see it and you realise, oh goodness, that really, now I know that really is going to happen to me. You know, now I know it really is going to happen to me more deeply. And that keeps on deepening in a way. You could say it's not a once and for all. And then every now and then you get that moment where something seems to click. But it's not a once and for all thing, which I think might. I think somebody else, you did ask earlier, didn't you? How many times, you know? So we should start to touch on that. How many times does this sort of process happen? You know, in terms of, we haven't quite defined spiritual death yet, but this process of the experience of suffering and the experience of possibility, it's not a once and for all thing. It's something that we experience more and more deeply. Yes, Ben?
I suppose we might see the same thing a number of different times, but I think we have moments which we remember as our milestones in our thinking.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I, for example, saw an elderly lady in Lewisham who was sort of bent over, and I remember very clearly that moment. And we have bits where we remember to change our attitudes or behaviours. They're almost crystal clear. We can remember at the age of 33, such and such husband, and they change our direction. So it's also psychological.
I think that's a very good way to look at it. We can, and that's what I mean by looking at this life story of the Buddha as a sort of archetypal life. We could think these things were literature. We could think it's those psychological moments, and I think that's putting on one of those milestones in our life, you know, which might be triggered by, they might be triggered by something external that's quite dramatic, or they might not. It might just be by that simple sight of an old lady, and you suddenly. Something goes deeper. Yes, Sarah.
Can I ask, why is there necessarily a connection between the first three and the last one? Because he could have seen those three men.
Yeah.
And he could have had the feelings of, realisation of suffering. And then he could have gone to see, as he did, the mendicant. And that doesn't necessarily mean that he would come out feeling that there's hope.
Yeah.
He would have still felt dispassionate. Depressed. Bemused incredulous. So what is it about him particularly and these conditions that meant that he came out feeling there was hope after seeing the mendicant?
That's a very good question. That leads me on to the next bit. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you asked that. Because it's not necessarily true. Even though I think we've kind of demonstrated that without one set, the other doesn't work. I think what you've said is absolutely true. It isn't of necessity. So just because... So let's take it back to our own lives as well. So just because we experience dukkha, it doesn't follow off, it doesn't necessarily follow that we'll have the confidence to take the next, to take a step. What the Buddha did was this step of leaving the palace. That doesn't necessarily follow. For the Buddha, it was that, as well as seeing this mendicant, there was, what do you think the quality was in the Buddha that made him be able to, that it did have an impact on him?
Well, I guess if you're looking for a solution,
mm-hmm.
or a way out, then you will find one in anything that you see, even if it doesn't necessarily objectively present that solution. If you really want to see something, you'll see it. Right? Uh-huh. If you really want to come out of Seamus Hall people feeling hopeful, you can spin it.
Okay, so let's, you can. So let me just take us through it step by step. So here's, actually, we will go back to the Buddha, having said we'll stick to our audience. But, so here's the Buddha, he's seen these three sides, he's feeling, oh God, you know, this is, like he's really probably starting to, well, he's having a crisis. Then he goes and sees that mendicant. Now, I think what you say is quite right, just seeing that mendicant, he could have just went, you know, but like, you know, we heard from over here, he'd just go, well, there's a mendicant, what's that got to do with anything? So what, is there a quality in the Buddha at that moment that meant that seeing that mendicant had the effect of giving him confidence that there was hope, even though he didn't quite know what the hope even was, but he saw that mendicant and somehow, a bit like Sal said, it gave him hope that maybe, you know, so is there
quality of faith, it touched something, is it receptivity?
Yeah, receptivity. I think there's a quality that he needed to see the side of the fourth side and he needed to have the receptivity. Like if he hadn't seen the fourth side, I think he would have got stuck, like we said, in some form. I mean, it might not have been a literal, you know, remember this side could have been an inner experience. But he also needed to be receptive to it, so he needed both. Is that, yeah?
So I think you could also maybe say it's a bit like recognition, because he recognised that he would get old and sick.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But maybe he also recognised that he recognised something about the mendicant, felt empathy or something with the mendicant, so it saw himself.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's an element of receptivity, that we can only be receptive, there's a sort of chiming or something, even if we don't quite know what it is. And that's when I imagine the Buddha seeing that mendicant, I don't think it was like suddenly he knew everything all at once. It was just a sort of sense, there was a sort of, it's like a glimmer of recognition, isn't it, I think. Yeah.
Is grace there? Grace.
Well, that could be another word, yeah. But I think receptivity is a more ordinary word that, I mean, if people are, yeah.
What was the quality that he saw in the mendicant that was leading him to hope towards?
That's a good question. What did any thoughts of what, how would you think the mendicant would have looked? Yeah, and had his hands shooting up. Yeah, he was probably begging, yeah. What else about him? How do you think he looked? He's in rags.
Open and free.
Open and free, yeah.
Serene.
How? Light. Serene, yeah. Light. Yeah. Light. How do you think he'd have been walking along?
Self-contained. But maybe interested as well.
Yeah.
The thing about the first three sites, surely, is that they create a lot of anxiety.
Perhaps
what he saw in the wandering mendicant was an absence of the kind of existential anxiety, so a kind of peace.
A kind of peace, very good. Yeah, very good. Sorry, I interrupted you. I thought I didn't see where you were going. But so a sort of peace, a calm sound?
I was thinking about, this archetypal story, but it seems like, why do we all come here?
Yeah.
Why do we all come here? Yeah. You know what I mean? It's something to do with, Dr. Murthy, I think you're great, but I don't think, I saw Dr. Murthy walking along. Intuitively, I came here because I was looking for something.
Yeah.
Intuitively.
Yeah.
Quite irrationally, almost. You know what I mean? I don't really relate to, and then there was this mendicant, he probably would look all, you know, spiritually groovy, and I want some of that. It's something else, like, lots of people, like, you know, that phrase, like, live lives of quiet desperation, you try and get all the pleasure you can, and ignore the fact you're going to die one day, and everyone gets sick and dies. But it's something to do with taking refuge. There's nowhere else to go.
Okay, good, let's come back to that. I'm just going to do a little time check. Oh yeah, good. Okay, so taking refuge in nowhere else. We'll come back to that. So, but let's just give this mendicant a lot better bit. Let's just imagine. I'll be back in the day and I think he's all stirred up. He sees this person. Just say this person is like calm, serene, mindful. His bearing seems, he's kind of maybe got a bit of a glow about him. I think that would have been attractive to the Buddha. And we can think in our own lives, is there anything, you know, say we come to the Buddha Center, go on a retreat, is there any sort of equivalent? Yes, the older members don't quite go around like that. But, you know, is there an atmosphere that's drawn us here? You know, is there something? Yeah? But we'll come back to the question of there's nowhere else to go. So I think what happened is, so let's even go with this so far. First three sites, dukkha. The next site, you've got this water mendicant who's got these qualities that seem to be the opposite of dukkha. The Buddha's in this existential crisis. The mendicant doesn't look like this as far as the Buddha can see. He looks calm and serene. And the Buddha's receptive to that. There's a sort of glimpse of a recognition. Something chimes. Enough at least to give him some sort of hope. He doesn't know the answer yet, but he gets some sort of hope. And that's enough to propel him to go forth, yeah? So I think I'm going to ask for your indulgence and letting us move on from this, you know, just so I can do a little bit more of the next bit. But you can come and see me afterwards if you you know, totally agree with all that. So where have we got? So we need a book. We realise that we can be disaffected with life without seeing an alternative, which could lead us to being disaffected and a bit nihilistic. But in the case that, so seeing this fourth sight for the Buddha represents seeing something that presents some sort of hope, and it's also something that you could say was new to the Buddha. He never seen anything quite like the first three sights before, but he'd never seen anything like this mendicant before. It was something new. It was as if he saw that there was a new possibility that hadn't existed in his mind before. It was like there was something opened up, a bigger perspective opened up. Yeah. Can people relate to that in their own experience? That sometimes something can happen, and I find it happens mostly on retreat, that a bigger perspective opens up that previously I had just was not within my experience before. It's a new thing. It's not just a sort of twist or a spin on the old things, on a slightly more positive way to think about them. It's a new way of seeing things that previously I didn't have access to before. Can people relate to that? Because I think that's what that foresight represents. It's more than just, oh, I'll look on the bright side. It's more than just I'll see these three sides, but I'll try and look on the bright side, you know. It's like actually a whole new quality is brought into being. So, let's see, what do I want to say next? Yeah, somebody on retreat actually said that to me. I'm on this recent winter retreat. Said to me afterwards, almost exactly that. He said that he realised that meditation, yes, meditation was quite a struggle actually at times, more than a struggle than he perhaps imagined. But he said the rewards and joy are so much deeper than what was available to me before. And I think that's quite a key thing, that something new coming into being, something new emerges, that sort of possibility of an alternative way of living life. It's like a greater scope of action. And a sort of glimpse of a possibility of freedom from this suffering that this represents. Yeah? We can't be free of literal death, but we can start to see that we can be free of the suffering and the fear of it. We can get a glimpse of that. So it's a new possibility. So I'm going to I'm going to move on now a little bit. I'm going to show you a diagram which I found really useful recently. And some of you have seen it before. We had this diagram on a recent Mitra dish. Here's a part of it. So this is the diagram. Can you see it from here? Okay, so what we've got... Sorry if it doesn't look exciting at all, but I think this is terribly exciting. So what we've got is... Okay, so we've got this bit going up. So this, imagine this is something reaching up, yeah? And imagine this is something reaching down. So I've written on this karma nema processes. Here's a little test. What does that mean? It's been coming along for a while. What's karma?
It's intentional action.
Hmm? Intentional action, yeah. What's nema? Causation law. I think it's more broad to say law, perhaps. So it's the processes that are to do with intentional action, yeah? Karma nema processes. So these are actions and processes that we're all probably quite familiar with. So this is the whole arena of ethics, of meditation, it's the whole arena of our whole life. But in our Buddhist practice, we'll be trying to make these processes more and more skillful. You know, people would be familiar, hopefully, with that word skillful, more and more towards enlightenment, yeah? Do people know what I mean when I say that so far? So, it's that we're reaching up. So that's what we're doing. We come along to the Buddhist center, we're attracted to the Dharma, we're attracted, you could say, to this something that seems to present a new perspective on life. And we think, I'll work towards that. I'm going to try my best and I'll work towards that because I'm attracted. I'll meditate, I'll practice skillful action, and that will start to move me towards this, yeah? So, what do I say next? So that's moving up. Okay, so now what have we got here? We've got this, as it were, moving down, right? It's like something, we're moving up towards something, and it's as if something's moving down towards us. And I've written Dharma Nyama processes. So what might that mean? If Nyama means law, Dharma means, what does Dharma mean?
Wisdom.
Teaching. Wisdom, yeah.
Truth.
So Dharma means truth. Dharma kind of means several things, but its ultimate meaning is truth. It can also mean the practices. When we talk about the Buddha's Dharma, we talk about the practices the Buddha gave to us to move towards truth, but we can also talk about Dharma as truth. And here we're talking about Dharma as truth. So what could this mean, Dharma Nyama processes?
It's as if it's a two-way thing. Yeah. As much as we are reaching up,
yeah,
it is actually the law actually that, yeah, it's moving towards us,
yeah,
beckoning us.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. It is that, and we're always careful to say it's as if that. Yeah?
As if, yeah.
It's as if that. It's as if we're reaching up, and it's as if something is reaching down to us. Yeah. It's as if we're reaching up towards something higher, and it's as if something higher, so Dharma Nyama processes, you could say, is all those processes by which human beings can become Buddhas. Yeah? The Dharma Nyama processes represent the possibility of enlightenment. They're those natural laws, it's not kind of magic, it's not fortuitous, they're the natural laws by which any human being can become a Buddha. The fact that's possible, we could call the Dharma Niyama process, and it's as if they reach down to us at the same time as we are reaching up. So why am I saying as if all the time?
You don't want us thinking about God.
Yeah, okay. That could be it, yeah. I certainly don't want us thinking about God in the sense of something that has actual sort of ontological, to use that word, existence, yeah? So there's, in a way you could say there's no thing that's reaching down. Also there's no thing that's reaching up, actually. We also don't have a fixed permanent self in order to reach up. And there's no thing with a fixed permanent self that can reach down. That's the kind of, that's the basic thing that Buddhism says. So at the same time, something happens, doesn't it? We go on retreat and we do experience this as if, we don't just experience as if, we experience this new perspective. And sometimes it can feel that that's something that's kind of come upon us, as it were. That something, I'll come to you in a minute, that something that hasn't come through our own will. Has anyone got a glimmer of what I mean by that in their experience of something that seems to not be through their own will? But it's something, it's an experience, yes?
Yes, a glimpse of self-forgetting. And it happened without... It was almost... there was no will involved because I just forgot myself for a moment, and there was a bliss feeling of, what a relief, all that has gone, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That horrible world, you know, that chatter.
Yeah.
And when I realised I was there, this is very different, and then I started thinking, well, how did that happen? And then I lost it.
And
there was
a
glimpse.
Yeah, there's a glimpse. And I think, how did that happen? Sort of was quite a good...
Yeah.
It's almost like, who would have thought that would have happened to me, you know, sort of thing. I'll just take your question, Ben, then I better move on.
What does ontological mean?
It means, well, it means just, what does it mean, actually? I really knew I should have used that word. It means kind of what's its status. It means, yeah. So what I do, I mean, is there's no actual kind of, if you ask, well, where is this? Where are these Dharma Niyama processes? You can't point and say, oh, they're definitely there. It's like, you know, some Christians might say, oh, there's definitely a heaven that definitely exists, yeah? So, from a Buddhist point of view, it's as true and as untrue to say that it's me doing this work or it's something else descending on me. But in the end, this will all break down. And that's why in this diagram these dotted lines start to appear. So up to a point, it's very, very important to think of ourselves as real, you know. We've got to think of ourselves as real agents, really meditating, really being kind and generous and so on. I've written spiritual death and spiritual rebirth going up the side here as progressive stages of a path. Can anybody remember what the first two stages of this path are? We've had 2 years on them already at the LBC.
Integration
and post-promotion. So you could stick them down in brackets. So we've had 2 years on them, but it's not like we've done them. So from the point of view of practicing integration and post-promotion, we've got to think of ourselves as an actually existing self that's trying to become happier and healthier and more skillful, yeah? We've got to think of that. But then, round about here, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, that starts to loosen up, yeah? There still is action happening, but it starts to be... Skillful action doesn't stop, it's just not willed in the same way. So, at the stage of a Buddha, the Buddha would just be spontaneously being kind, except he wouldn't be being kind because it would just be like what a Buddha did. It wouldn't be will. There'd be no sense of, I've got to practice being kind here. And so say the Buddha's right up here. It just would be natural. A Buddha couldn't be otherwise. So it's not willed. But it's like it's not intentional, and that, the, you know, we said that karmic action is intentional action, because there's no choice. Intentional sort of suggests that there's just, but there's no choice in the most positive way, that you're just a bit like we might experience a glimmer if we really love somebody and they need help. We can almost feel there's, you've got no, you just want to help them, don't you? It's just a natural thing. Well, imagine the Buddha just feels that to all beings all the time. So right up here there's the Buddha, right down here there's us trying to be as skillful as we can, but it starts to attenuate. We're still acting, but it's less and less our personal will. Yeah? Are people with me? Yeah,
you mean it's less your personal will because it's more natural? You just do it more naturally?
Yeah, you do it more naturally, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's less your personal will because you feel less of a tight personal self. You know, you've more expanded your being, so it's more like, you know, you could say you're including more beings within your being, if you wanted to put it like that. You're less experiencing yourself as a tight and separate self. So that's starting to go in a dotted line up here. And then this is starting to go into a dotted line down here, because it's not, we're kind of focusing on spiritual death and spiritual rebirth as the point where the karma niyama process kind of gives way and the dharma niyama process takes over. Mm-hmm. But it's not like that just suddenly starts here. Like right back, we'll come back to this in a minute, right from the very beginning of our career, as it were, for Buddhas, we will experience some sort of sense of these Dharma Niyama processes. We'll experience something drawing us on, as it were. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I'll say a little bit more and hope it sort of makes sense. So, you could say, you could kind of, not exactly correlate them, but you could say in this Dharma Niyama, this Karma Niyama process, you could say that that's our responses to the first, that's a sort of how we might respond to the first three sites. And the Dharma Niyama process is a bit like that new thing coming in that we hadn't yet imagined, that if we practice spiritual receptivity, we might start to get glimpses of. You could say, again to use sort of technical, come slightly jargonistic terms, but I think they're useful, is that these karma niyama processes are what you might call self-power. That's when you're working on yourself, and these dharma niyama processes are what you might call other power. Now remember, in the Dharma there's ultimately that distinction between self and other will break down. So we're only calling it that for the time being. But that's what it'll feel like. It'll feel like I'm kind of going ahead with my, you know, I'm trying my best and so on. That will take us so far. But we need to allow for what you might call an experience of other power carefully, because you don't want to make the other sound like a definite thing that's out there. But it'll feel like that. So it's just if you can keep loose to that. You could call this a path of self-development. And you could call this a sort of path, or maybe in Catholic, of self-surrender, that you're giving yourself to something higher. Again, it's quite interesting to ask yourself the question of what, I've seen that you need both. Like self-development without self-surrender, you're either going to be good at it and think, oh well, I'm great at this, on the bee's knees, but actually you're just tightening the sense of self, or else you're going to be not good at it, you think, I'm a failure, I might as well give up the spiritual life. Yeah. If a path of self-surrender without self-development, well, you're just going to, you know, give yourself over to the first guru that, you know, asks you for all your money, aren't you? You know, you're going to, you need both a sense of self and a self of other. You can say, again, to use a technical term, that that's the sort of going forth. You need a sense of going forth from sort of suffering, and I think this might tie in with what Sal said, that sometimes you just think, well, there's nowhere else to go. I've just got to, I don't know what else there is, but I know that I know I can't keep on doing this. So that's like going forth. Going for refuge is when you see, it's like when you actually see that there's something to move towards, yeah? You could sort of, even if you remember that crude way to say it, it's like a sort of carrot and stick, you know, that's the, you're pushed from behind here, and here you're opening up to something higher. And it's been interesting talking to Jnana Vacher about all this in preparation for the seminar, because what he kept saying to me is, he says, when you give the first week on the seminar, he said, you've got to talk about Shraddha. Shraddha means confidence, faith, confidence. Yeah, it means placing the part upon, your heart upon. Jnana Vacher was saying, you've got to have Shraddha in order to open up, yeah, in order to spiritually die, yeah, which I'm using that term around for the first time, in order to spiritually die, which means letting go of this sense of self, you've got to have faith that there is something to let go into. So that's what Jnana Vacher was saying. He says, you've got to talk about Shraddha. And I was saying, look, Jnana Vacher, I just don't experience it like that. I don't experience that, I experience it like I'm going along and I'm thinking, this is too painful, or I'm causing too much pain. Like my anger, my irritation, everything that I do that's negative, it just causes too much pain for everyone else, never mind myself. I've got to just stop it. And then I make effort to stop it. And then it's like almost to my delight, I find that I'm not annihilated. My fear is if I let go of all this, there'll be nothing left because it's so much, I'm so much identified with it. Who would I be if I wasn't irritable half the time? You know, if I let go of it, I'll only be half a person, you know. And then I have managed to let go of it, not completely, I have to say, but a little bit from time to time. And I was, gosh, there is that, there is, it's not annihilation, there is something more. So I don't know if that means like he's just been practicing more deeply than me, or what I like to think is it's a difference of temperament, that some of us will be more kind of propelled. We'll, the spiritual death for which you could read the going forth will happen because we just can't hack this anymore. We just can't, you know, it's too much. You know, we've seen the four sides, we've seen the three sides, we just can't go on. We've got to let go, there's no alternative. And then we'll find that there's something on the other side. But for Jnana Vacher, he would say, no, if I didn't have the faith there was something to go towards, I couldn't let go. So I think, and I think, the more I think about it, I think both are true, and I think it's probably quite handy that we're both leading the seminar. I know he's not here this week, but it's almost like we come at it from a different sort of side, as it were. So just maybe, because I need to sort of start winding up here, but spiritual death and spiritual rebirth are like both sides of this coin. So spiritual death is when you start to let go of the old you. You start to let go of the old way of being, that you start, because you see it's causing yourself and others suffering. You start to realise, I can't go on like this. And spiritual rebirth is that you realise that in that letting go, actually, it's not annihilation, there's something more. Yeah, and that can happen both ways, and maybe different temperaments and different times in our lives, yeah? So here I've drawn this path going integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. That's a Buddha, spontaneous, compassionate activity. You could equally draw these along a sort of horizontal axis, that they're there, like at every step of the way, these are present. It's not that you kind of do your integration, you do your positive emotion, and then you kind of get a shot at spiritual death, and then after that you have spiritual rebirth. And I think this ties in with some of the other points of why now and how long does it take and so on. In a way, as a matter of fact, could you quickly draw that little them going along the bottom, integration, positive emotion, spiritual receptivity, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Yeah. Just like this, along the bottom of that. You don't need to draw it sideways. So broadly speaking, you could see these as things that we're doing all the time. And broadly speaking, you could see, do you remember the list that we reflected on after meditation? What do we do when the going gets tough? Is it helpful or not? You could see the move from the shift. You could see the spiritual death or going forth is letting go of the things. It's just looking at your own space. What's not helpful? It's just letting go of them, yeah? And then looking at your experience, what was helpful or what was a bit more helpful? And you start going for refuge more towards those things that actually did help. And you start going forth from those things that didn't help. So you're using your own experience, and sometimes you might consciously decide to make a small leap of faith. So we might make an announcement about, for example, going on a longer retreat. And you might think, okay, I've been on a 5-day one or a 2-day one. I got a glimmer of what they were on about from that. I think a 10-day one might give me even more. So that's what I mean by a conscious leap of faith. It's not a blind faith, but you might make that conscious leap. So does that, I'll sort of wind up there, but does that, so that's broadly speaking, the move from spiritual death to spiritual rebirth. It'll really happen when we completely let go of our sense of self, completely, when we realise that we're not a fixed separate self. That'll be sort of real spiritual death, as it were, and real spiritual rebirth. There'll be no going back. We'll never be convinced again by our old way of being. It's just like you would have seen something and we can never be reconvinced of the old way. So that'll be a definitive turning point here. But until we get there, we can also be doing it all the time as well. Yeah, every step of the way, every moment we've got a chance to practice, you know, letting go of the old way of being. That's a little mini spiritual death. And being receptive to something new that can come into being. Or it might happen the other way around. We're drawn towards something and that allows us to let go of the old way of being. Yeah, is that? So I hope I've given you a broad picture. So I want to wind up there. Sorry there's no time for any more questions because we're going to do our puja in 5 minutes. But just to say that next week we've got the talk. The week after that, I'm going to be talking about both within this more karma, niyama, self-development, self-power, if you like, sort of mode, things we can actually do to get better at this, as it were, to practice that kind of letting go and that practice allowing ourselves to open up. Then it'll be Nyanavansha's turn, and I don't know exactly what he'll say, but I think he'll talk about more of this, how to cultivate the faith more and more, and it's something to let go into, yeah? And then we're also going to cover subjects like, you know, I want to do a week on, for example, ordination, you know, with a sort of path of ordination in this movement, we have the possibility of ordination. How does that tie in with all this? So that's the kind of things we're going to be covering. So I hope to see you again. It always turns out a bit of a whirlwind tour. I hope that's made some sense. Do ask me after if you've got more questions. Thank you.